the headlines. Iran says the United States needs to commit to clear action steps if it genuinely wants an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal. North Korea's leader heats up the rhetoric against the U.S. in a speech on the Korean War Armistice Anniversary. And U.S. carrier strike group is back in the South China Sea amid simmering tensions with Beijing over Nancy Pelosi's possible visit to Taiwan. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's foreign minister has reiterated Tehran's determination to reach a good and durable agreement to revive the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. Amir Abdullahian said a good agreement would be at hand if the American side took realistic steps in that direction. Iran's top diplomat said if the U.S. is really willing to clinch a deal with Iran, it must prove this in practice. Amir Abdullahian also touched on Borrell's proposed text for an agreement to revive the JCPOA, saying that Iran welcomes continuation of talks and diplomacy. Borrell, for his part, said the Iranian side has so far proven its serious resolve during the JCPOA revival talks, and it's time for those talks to bear fruit. This came a day after Borrell wrote in a Financial Times article that he has put on the table a draft agreement to revive the JCPOA. He said the proposed text addresses the removal of anti-Iran sanctions and some of the remaining differences. Masoud Shajadeh, head of London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, says the West should not expect Iran to fulfill its JCPOA commitments if it cannot reap economic benefits of the deal.
The reality is that I think it is only right to say that if Iran is not going to benefit from economically and from removal of the sanction, then the West should not be in a position and actually expect the part of Iran to be fulfilled by the Iranian. And I just hope that we will see the end of this tit-for-tat and the United States and the West will decide to uphold its commitment, so Iran could go back to its commitment also. But I think what is very obvious is that commitment cannot be one-sided.
North Korea has issued a stern warning to the U.S., saying it's ready for any military clash. Tensions have been running high between the two countries for years now over Pyongyang's nuclear program. We discussed the issue with two political analysts in our news review program. Let's take a listen to their comments. On this segment of the program, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country is ready to mobilize its nuclear war deterrent and is prepared for any military clash with the U.S. Kim was speaking at an event marking the 69th anniversary of the Korean War Armistice. He also warned that South Korean administration and military could be annihilated if it makes what he called dangerous attempts. Kim's speech came after Seoul and Washington said Pyongyang had completed preparations to conduct its first nuclear test since 2017. South Korea also said the North could face more sanctions if it conducts the test. North Korea says its nuclear program is for self-defense against threats posed by the U.S. and its regional allies. Pyongyang is particularly opposed to joint war games by Washington and Seoul. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have political analyst Andrew Loing joining us from Hong Kong, and we also have political analyst Inner Tangen, who's joining us from Beijing. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Loing in Hong Kong. Why are we seeing all this aggressive rhetoric from both sides when usually an armistice anniversary should be a day of commemorating peace?
It's not just a question of these military joint exercises by the United States with South Korea. It is the result of almost decades of so-called negotiations trumping America's supremacy and demanding a kind of all-or-nothing kind of solution in terms of North Korea's self-defense capabilities. And I think that Kim has now totally lost trust in the American administration, whether it be Trump or his successors or Biden or whatever. I think that Kim is now taking his own defense of his country in his own hands, and taking a leaf from Chairman Mao's book of developing his own nuclear deterrence against foreign intimidation and coercion. And I think that this is, explains the recent tests, including nuclear capability as well as delivery systems. Because I think that Kim learns that it's only when it is in control of critical nuclear deterrence that it can ensure his regime's stability against coercion by the United States, let alone from South Korea. Because as far as South Korea is concerned, in fact, the North Koreans does not have to rely on nuclear weapons. Let's not forget that many cannons, hundreds of cannons, are positioned within less than 100 kilometers from Seoul. So at the drop of a hat, all these cannons can be fired and obliterate Seoul in a matter of hours. So I think that all this posturing by the United States with South Korea is not going to change North Korea's determination to take self-defense in its own hands in terms of nuclear capability together with its delivery systems.
Andrew Tang, and focusing on the language of threats that we're seeing, North Korea is threatening to use nuclear deterrence, destroy the South's military, confront the U.S., and South Korea has been talking about tougher sanctions. Do you think that the Korean Peninsula is headed towards more confrontation with the new government in Seoul?
Well, let's hope not. I mean, the fact is that North Korea has had nuclear weapons for quite some time. There's nothing new that's added to the equation, apart from if they do decide to go forward with an underground nuclear test. In that case, both South Korea and the United States have promised some sort of reaction. I don't know how much many more sanctions they can add on. It seems to be an empty bucket in that regard. But, you know, there's all these threats going around. It's a bipolar universe. People are either on one side or the other. I think that's a false equivalency. There's probably somewhere in between. But a nuclear North Korea does raise the specter of an arms race in the rest of Asia. Obviously, South Korea and Japan have the capabilities to have their own nuclear weapons in a relatively short period of time because of the technology they possess. And this would make the world less stable rather than more.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Andrew Loewing, political analyst, joining us from Hong Kong, and Ainer Tangen, political analyst, speaking to us from Beijing. That's it with this edition of the News Review. Moving on, a U.S. aircraft carrier and its strike group have returned to the South China Sea after a port call in Singapore. American officials confirmed the deployment of the USS Ronald Reagan to the region. They say the carrier is continuing its normal and scheduled operations as part of its routine patrol. Meanwhile, Beijing dismissed the presence of American warships in the South China Sea as a threat to peace and stability there. The deployment in the disputed region comes as tensions run high between the two powers over a possible upcoming visit to Taiwan by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory, believes U.S. military and political support for the island emboldens its pro-independence forces. When it comes to U.S. weapon sales, it's not just about profits. Washington's foreign policy initiatives should also be counted, as can be seen in its deals with countries in West Asia. But the U.S. aggression against China is another reason which may explain why it's planning to sell almost $1 billion worth of arms to Japan and Singapore.
The United States has given the green light to more arms sales to East Asian nations in a bid to counter China. The package of arms and munitions, which is worth $900 million, has been approved by the State Department and is set to be sold to Australia, Japan, and Singapore. A potential deal with Australia includes 80 Lockheed Martin precision-guided air-to-surface missiles and associated equipment. The deal, which is said to be worth $235 million, will allow Australian jets to stay outside the range of the opponent's air defense units while launching attacks. Back in April, Canberra approved that $2.44 billion US dollars worth of, quote, improved weapon capabilities be quickly delivered to the country from the US. Australian officials claim they need the equipment to meet the country's increasingly complex and challenging strategic environment. The package for Japan would include 150 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles. The missiles, which are to be installed on the country's F-35 fighter jets, are worth more than $290 million. Singapore will receive $630 million to supply its fighter jets with air-to-air missiles. Australia, Japan, and Singapore are considered US allies in the Indo-Pacific region against what Washington describes as the rising threat from China.
Yeah, this one, these sales of weapon to Japan and Singapore basically came after a speech of General Milley, where he complained about the aggression, the posture of the Chinese military, especially the pilot, when they intercept any aircraft from the United States or from their ally. So they said that they wanted to give a weapon to be effective against possible interception of aircraft.
Washington's policy towards Beijing has taken a military turn. Hot-button issues like Taiwan, trade war, and the disputed islands in the South China Sea are examples of such tensions, and it's widely believed that the latest U.S. arms sales to countries in the East Asia region are to counter the influence of China. But the real question is whether these countries are on board the U.S. aggressive push against China.
The sales of advanced weapons to U.S. allies in the region come amid rising rivalries between the United States and China. Washington is pursuing a policy of cooperation and coordination with regional countries against China. It aims to push these countries to contribute more to joint regional military programs. It's now believed that the United States, which has been the preeminent military power in that region for decades, can no longer guarantee by itself a regional balance of power. Global geopolitics is changing, contrary to the expectations and demands of politicians in Washington. It's now an open secret that China is a rising military and economic powerhouse in the East Asia region. With major advances in missile technology, naval forces and intelligence, China is well on its way to becoming world-class military power. It has already surpassed Washington in several areas. And apart from that, China has massive economic ties with the regional countries.
With the exception of four countries that are already, for historical reason, very much linked to the United States from a military point of view, it means South Korea, Japan, New Zealand, and Australia. All of the other countries here are quite difficult that they can enter in a kind of alliance, a military alliance, as the NATO in Europe. There are many reasons. There are political reasons, but also economic reasons, because China is growing so fast and their economy, the economy of these countries, are very much interconnected with the China one.
China is concerned about the belligerent rhetoric coming from the U.S. Beijing and Washington have been at odds over several issues in recent years, including trade and the South China Sea. But Beijing's ultimate concern is Washington's meddling in Chinese Taipei. China has made it clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to secede. It has already strongly warned against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the dispute over the strategic island may prove to be a real challenge between the two superpowers in the coming years.
Well, dozens of former U.S. officials, both Republican and Democrat, are going to announce a third national political party. They say the new party will appeal to millions of voters dismayed with the country's, quote, dysfunctional two-party system. The new party, called Forward, will initially be co-chaired by a former Democratic presidential candidate and a former Republican governor of New Jersey. The founding members hoped the party would become a viable alternative to the Republican and Democratic parties. The new party is being formed by a merger of three political groups that have emerged in recent years as a reaction to America's increasingly polarized and gridlocked political system. A Gallup poll last year showed a record two-thirds of Americans believed a third party was needed. No information has been released on the policy of the party, which will be centrist. Well, Ukraine says it will increase electricity exports to the European Union as the bloc faces an energy crisis triggered by reduced gas supplies from Russia.
We are preparing to increase our electricity exports to consumers in the European Union. Despite the war, we secured the connection of the Ukrainian power grid to the entire European energy system in a record time. Our exports allow us not only to generate foreign currency revenues, but also help our partners withstand Russian energy pressure.
Zelensky added that his country will become one of the guarantors of European energy security. The Ukrainian power grid was connected to the European network in mid-March. The connection enabled Ukraine to receive electricity from Europe if military attacks caused outages. In early July, Ukraine started exporting electricity to the EU via Romania. On Wednesday, Germany said Russia has cut gas deliveries to Europe via the Nord Stream 2 or the Nord Stream pipeline to about 20% of capacity, down from 40%. EU countries accuse Russia of reducing gas supplies in response to Western sanctions imposed on Moscow over the Ukraine war. Moscow, however, blames technical issues with a pipeline for gas supply cuts. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. The Battle of Uhud had finished. Someone like Hamza, Sayyid al-Shuhada, had been martyred in this battle. The Quraysh, their agents, went into Medina and started frightening people. They came and asked the people, Do you know what's happening? Have you heard? The enemy has gathered and has prepared an army. They want to put an end to you. They will attack tonight, and they will do this and do that. They, the enemy, was intimidating the people. Those who were the target of this intimidation said, Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee. The Muslims went, defeated them, and returned. So they returned with favor from Allah. They obtained a large amount of spoils from the battle, and no problem arose for them. They defeated the enemy and returned. This is divine tradition. So, if in the face of the enemy's intimidation, you truly have faith that Allah is sufficient for us and He is an excellent trustee, and if you do your duty, this will be the outcome, the victory. This part of chapter Ali Imran tells us this tradition. This is what happened after the Battle of Uhud. Perhaps this was about a few hours after the end of the Battle of Uhud.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
That other case was related to the Battle of Uhud itself. In the Battle of Uhud, the Muslims were victorious in the beginning of the battle. First, they attacked and crushed the enemy. But when they neglected the strait because of worldliness, the situation became reversed. Again, in chapter Al-Imran, the Qur'an states that, And certainly Allah made good to you His promise. The Holy Qur'an, Surah 3, 152. God fulfilled His promise to you. He had said, We promised that we will make you victorious if you struggle on the path of God. He carried out His promise. When you slew them by His permission. The Holy Qur'an, Surah 3, verse 152. You were able to put pressure on them, the enemy, and to defeat them due to God's grace. You succeeded in the beginning of the battle. So God did what He had promised in this part.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
light fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel has a history of either attempting to or conducting acts of terrorism in Iran, but more often than not, Tehran successfully discovers and prevents such attacks. On Saturday, Iran's intelligence ministry issued a statement saying that members of a terrorist group affiliated with Mossad were identified and arrested by Iranian security forces before they could take any action to carry out acts of sabotage. The ministry added that terrorists who were in contact with Mossad agents through one of the neighboring countries had sneaked into the country while carrying highly explosive bombs. Later, reports emerged that the espionage planned to blow up a sensitive facility in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. This, however, isn't the first time Israel had planned on carrying out acts of terrorism in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's intelligence ministry forces had also captured individuals linked to Mossad in April. The spies were involved in disseminating classified information and documents. In July, Iran arrested another network of agents while they were carrying a large cache of weapons and ammunition with the intentions of provoking riots and terror inside the country.
Earlier in March, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps foiled yet another Israeli act of terror. The Islamic Revolution Guard Corps said it stopped an imminent Israeli plot to sabotage the Fordow uranium enrichment plant.
Israel has, however, conducted a few terrorist acts against Iran over the past years, namely the murder of top Iranian scientists and army generals and acts of sabotage on nuclear sites. Yet, interestingly enough, the regime continues such atrocities without being held accountable by the international community, and more specifically the U.S., who has supported Israel through its veto power in the United Nations Security Council.
The impunity with which Israel carries out such attacks or in this case, makes such plans, is fully enabled by the United States of America, which at this point, I believe, should be deemed responsible for the crimes and the destabilization that the apartheid state of Israel engages in. The primary way that the United States enables the crimes and the destabilization of Zionism and the colonialist apartheid state of Israel is through its veto in the United Nations. Since 1972, the United States has vetoed 53 resolutions attempting to hold Israel to account by way of international law.
Israel has been involved in a string of sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities in recent years and has killed many top nuclear scientists and military officials in cowardly strikes. More recently, on May 22nd, Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodai was assassinated by two motorcyclists who shot him five times before fleeing the scene. He was dismounting his car to enter his home in an eastern neighborhood of the Iranian capital when three bullets hit him in the head and two bullets in the hand. While Israel has yet to officially comment on the incident or take blame, all reports and facts indicated that it has so far been behind the terrorist activities in Iran. Regarding the Khodai case, American outlet The New York Times cited an intelligence official as saying that Israel has informed American officials that it was behind the assassination. Despite all this, the regime continues its petty attempts of trying to accuse Iran of destabilizing the region.
Israel attacks its neighbors on almost a daily basis, for example, bombing Syria, whereas Iran has not attacked a neighboring country in over 300 years, or almost 300 years. Furthermore, the very well-known international human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, as well as B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, have deemed Israel to be an apartheid state, which inherently, as such, destabilizes the region. So there's nothing new here in terms of the Israeli and American narrative, their propaganda regarding Iran. What I do see as new and heartening is the fact that the effectiveness of this narrative is weakening very rapidly.
Israeli atrocities have also garnered fierce response from Iranian officials. The chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has warned that Iran will take a harsh revenge on those who assassinated a member of the force in Tehran.
The commander of the Iranian army's ground force has warned that Tehran will raise Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel makes any attempts against Tehran. Brigadier General Qumars Haydari also stated that Israeli occupied territories will be liberated in less than 25 years. Russia says it might go beyond Donbas, where it once laid the lines of the conflict in Ukraine. The shift was articulated by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who said one reason Russia might expand its operation are the longer-range rockets and artillery the US and NATO allies have been funneling to Ukraine.
The geography is different now. It is not only about the DNR and the LNR, but also about the Kherson region, the Zaporizhia region, and a number of other territories, and this process is continuing consistently and persistently.
Lavrov's remarks are the clearest comments that Russia's objectives have expanded over the 5 months of war. Earlier, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Lavrov's statement confirmed what Washington and its allies had suspected were Russian President Vladimir Putin's objectives all along.
He has stated a number of times that, you know, this is a limited operation focused on the Donbas. His actions have proven otherwise.
The U.S., despite claiming that it knew about Russia's intentions, only seems to be further fueling the war through its support for Kiev. The U.S.'s military assistance has topped $8 billion U.S. dollars, part of a $40 billion aid package. And all this while analysts view diplomacy as the only tangible solution to the ongoing conflict.
The U.S. empire's strategic aim is to expand NATO eastwards, right up to the borders of the Russian Federation, stage coups where necessary, as in Ukraine in 2014. And in the words of Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, to vanquish Russia, divide it up and gobble up its component parts, the better to march on to China. It's a hegemonic agenda, and there is no way that the U.S. will tolerate the Ukrainian government having a negotiated peace with Russia. Rather, the plan is that to drag the Russian Federation into a long war.
Washington claims to be supporting Ukraine to defend itself. Officials in Kiev have, however, suggested that Crimea, which the West still recognizes as part of Ukraine, could be a target for US-made missiles recently deployed by Kiev. The remark, however, prompted a fierce response from the former Russian president, warning that an attack on Crimea will ignite a Judgment Day response. The West, led by the U.S., apart from supplying financial aid, has also imposed a wide range of unprecedented sanctions against Moscow in support for Kiev. The bans have targeted individuals, banks, businesses, and state-owned enterprises, including the oil and gas sector.
The U.S. also planned an economic war on Russia by leveling economic sanctions, which are unilateral and illegal, by excluding Russia from the SWIFT transfer system, by stealing its monetary resources stored in Western banks, and by cutting it off from its natural trading partners in Europe.
The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries, global supply chains have been disrupted, and there are fears of food shortages. But now, experts fear the situation, especially in Europe, could further deteriorate as the continent struggles to find middle grounds on solutions to the current uncertainties.
But the U.S. sanctions backfired on the West, especially on Europe, where Europe took the brunt of the energy cutbacks. And it caused, the U.S. war caused an inflationary crisis for the entire world.
All this has also led to indications of fatigue settling in the EU. The Hungarian Prime Minister has so far been the most vocal about his concerns regarding the bloc's strategies on Ukraine.
West's strategy on Ukraine has failed as governments in Europe are collapsing like dominoes. Energy prices have surged. A new strategy is needed, which should focus on peace talks and drafting a good peace proposal instead of winning the war.
But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way. While standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. The International Energy Agency has even warned that a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch this winter awaits Europe, mainly due to the possibility of Russia cutting off gas supplies completely.
U.S. President Joe Biden just visited the West Asia to promote Washington's agenda in that region. Apart from encouraging Washington's Arab allies to pump more oil into the market to bring down rising energy prices, Biden, on behalf of the Israeli regime, was trying to form a coalition against Iran. But the much-publicized event failed to garner support from the United States' Arab allies. Now, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the latest plot in the West Asia region failed because the regional countries do not trust Washington. Kanani also said Iran considers the security of its neighbors as its own security.
The Saudis are recognizing the U.S. is in decline, and Joe Biden is the symbol of America's decline, mentally, politically, socially, religiously. And they have embarked on a different geopolitical, economic, military agenda, and that is to unite with the BRICS nations and seek their political destiny elsewhere than within the United States. So I think Joe Biden's trip was an absolute failure. It didn't accomplish anything, and we knew it wouldn't accomplish anything.
Just the day before the summit between Biden and the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries, plus Egypt, Jordan and Iraq, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, the Prime Minister of Iraq, said Baghdad will not be part of any camp or military alliance. He also said, quote, Iraq will not be a base for threatening any neighboring countries. The UAE, which is a close ally of both Saudi Arabia and the US, also dismissed the idea of forming an anti-Iran NATO-like military alliance. We are open to cooperation, but not cooperation targeting any other country in the region, and I specifically mention Iran. Such comments show that Biden, who has practically followed the anti-Iran policies of his predecessor Donald Trump, failed to achieve his stated objective of forming a military alliance against Tehran.
So this entire trip of Joe Biden's was a futile effort, wasted effort, and I think it only depreciated America in the eyes of other nations. And for that reason, other nations are seeking political alliances elsewhere, in other global institutions, such as the BRICS nations and the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative and other things.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman also dismissed the recent Israeli threats against the Islamic Republic as psychological warfare. Nasser Kanani says the Tel Aviv regime has neither the courage nor the capability to confront Iran militarily. He also vowed that Tehran would give a decisive and destructive response to any Israeli aggression. Iran's response to any idiocy committed by the Zionist regime would be destructive.
Not only is the United States incapable of any military conflict, But Israel is also incapable of any military conflict. And Israel is about, is incapacitated, yet they are putting on an aura of functionality, an aura of threats. But at the heart, Israel has no capacity to wage a conflict against Iran. This is all bluff, and this trip confirms it.
Kanani's comments come in response to threats made by Israeli Army Chief Aviv Kohavi. The Israeli general has said, quote, it's Israel's moral obligation to prepare a military response against Iran's nuclear program. He also added that such preparations for such a strike are at the center of the military's program. Kohavi's warmongering rhetoric against the Islamic Republic comes despite Iran's insistence that it's not seeking to develop nuclear weapons. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has issued a religious decree against weapons of mass destruction. And just recently, Kamal Kharazi, the head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations, rejected allegations that Iran seeks nuclear weapons. He said Iran has the technical capability to go beyond the current 60% uranium enrichment level, but it will not go that path. It's an open secret that Israel is the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the region and has hundreds of warheads. The regime's officials have constantly threatened Iran with strikes on its nuclear facilities. The regime is responsible for the murder of a number of Iran's nuclear scientists. It has also carried out sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities. And its latest threats against Iran are just meant to shore up its crumbling hegemonic position.
As the crisis in Ukraine lingers on, the United States and its allies appear to run out of measures to halt Russia. They have imposed various sanctions on Moscow. Russia's energy, banking, and financial sectors have been targeted by the West. But the punitive measures do not appear to have the intended results. Now, the United States is proposing the idea of putting a price cap on Russia's oil.
Yeah, I mean, this is more suicidal stuff from the West. I mean, one thing which this Western-centric, this US-centric, European-centric view of themselves as being indispensable parts of the world, I think is the main problem here, because they view themselves as the center of the universe, so to speak, in everything, in politics, economics, etc. However, they fail to understand that the world is rapidly changing.
The West is trying to limit the price of Russia's oil in order to deprive the country from the money it needs to run the war. The goal is said to be to set the price at a level that covers the marginal cost of production so that Russia would be encouraged to keep producing oil. The idea, which was first proposed by Washington, was agreed upon at the G7 summit back in June. Western countries plan to allow only those raw material and oil products whose value does not exceed the price cap. In reaction to the proposed idea, Russia has threatened that it would not export oil to the world market if a price cap is imposed. If these prices, which they are talking about, are lower than the costs for oil production, naturally, Russia will not ensure the supply of this oil to the world market, which means that we simply will not work at a negative profit. It's not yet clear whether Western nations have the capability to implement such a plan, but there are already warnings that this scheme may actually backfire. Russia's president says the price cap would further propel global oil prices, and Security Council Deputy Chairman Dmitry Medvedev has warned that oil would be traded between $300 to $400 per barrel if the West goes through with the plan.
The European markets and the US markets are not the prime markets for Russian energy supplies. The prime markets are now Asia, and so they're out of step with what is happening in the world. And what this will do will exacerbate, as you noted, an already rather tenuous energy crisis, which is caused by, on the one hand, shortages of energy supplies, and on the other hand, costs of energy supplies. because to cap it, who's going to sell it to the West under the production cost? No one, especially when the West treats them the way that they are treating them. So, I mean, it's going to be another shot in the foot for the US and its vassal and client states.
Some analysts are predicting that the scenario would be catastrophic for the U.S. and the other group of seven countries. Market watchers have predicted that China and India, two key players in the Asia region, may not cooperate with the price cap. Western sanctions on Russia have already failed to deprive the country from its revenues. They have actually increased the money Moscow makes from its energy exports. Oil prices climbed to 14-year highs shortly after the war began on February 24. They remain above $100 per barrel. According to other analysts, history shows that such attempts end in failure. The US tried to fix prices for oil in the 1970s, and the UK tried to set the forex prices in the 80s. All those attempts failed, and the prices boomed after those debacles.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your host, Zainab. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, said, "The man who does not know the Imam of his time will die the death of an ignorant." But in this program, we try to make sure that you get the maximum information about the Imam of your time so that we do not die the death of an ignorant. Today, to discuss about Mehtaviyat, to discuss more on du'as, we have with us in studio Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Dr. Karimi, in our previous session, we talked about the Dua Ahad, the content of Dua Ahad, and you explained fully how Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, what he says about this Dua in the narration, and this narration from Imam Sadiq that the one who recites this Dua for 40 consecutive days will be among the soldiers of Imam. Even if he is dead, he gets revived. Gives a kind of hope to us, to all believers, that yes, we have to perform our part of the duty. Allah is promising us a lot of things. Then moving towards the content, you explored a lot of things in the content. The main thing, the most important thing was monotheism. We found Tawheed, we found oneness, we're describing different attributes of Allah in the dua. So yes, we had some remaining portion from the content of dua. I would want you to continue with that.
Thank you for that summary. Yes, after that part, we also said that in this dua, we update the covenant between ourselves and the imam. If you're updating your covenant with the imam for 40 days, I believe it will change your life drastically. It changes our attitude toward the life. And maybe that is the reason Imam Sadiq alayhi salam explains all those rewards for reciting and reading this dua. It's not only about repeating some words in Arabic without understanding. No. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam expects us to, when we say that Allahumma inni ujaddidu, O Allah, I'm updating the covenant, then it means that, so what that covenant is all about? What are my duties? What are my responsibilities? Maybe we can say that only in that case we would be among the people that would be revived after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. There are some supplications like Allahumma ja'alni min ansarihi wa ahwani. O Allah, please do make me of his supporters, defenders, and those who hurry in carrying out his instructions. Now, many people may claim to obey the Prophet and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, but the concept which is put emphasized on in this part is al-musari'ina ilayh, those who hurry in carrying out these instructions. So many people may obey the infallibles, but some people with delay. وَالْمُمْتَثِلِينَ لَأَوَامِرِهِ, those who comply with his orders. وَالْمُحَامِينَ عَنْ, those who uphold him. وَالسَّابِقِينَ إِلَىٰ إِرَادَتِهِ, those who precede others to implementing his will. وَالْمُسْتَشَهَدِينَ بَيْنَ يَدَيْهِ, and those who would be martyred before him. Now, the next part is directly related to the concept of raj'ah that we talked about in the previous session. We say that, O God, if death that you have made inevitably and certainly incumbent upon your servants, so it's referring to the concept of death.
Yes.
But then please do take me out of my grave, which is referring to the concept of raj'ah. And then the dua explains about the future. So as I mentioned, this is one of the Islamic beliefs. It's not only a Shi'i belief, it is rooted in the verses of the Quran. And this part of the dua is directly referring to the fact that, O Allah, if I'm not alive at that time after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, alayhi salam, please include me among the people who would be revived based on the concept of raj'ah. The next part of the dua refers to some other supplications, the fact that the grief of all the people would be removed only by the reappearance of the imam. Allahumma kshif hadhihi al-ghummata an hadhihi al-ummati bihudurihi. O Allah, relieve this community from the current grief through presenting him, through the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and hasten in his reappearance. And the last point, innahum yarawnahu ba'idan wa narahu qariba. This is a very profound phrase in this dua. They, which is also referring to a verse in the Noble Book of Quran, surely they think it is very far off, but we see it very close and nigh, referring to the fact that as Shia, as Muslims, we need to be always hopeful about the future. We see it, we consider it as nigh. Rahmatika ya arhamar rahimin. And then we repeat al-ajal, al-ajal, ya maulaya sahib al-zaman, by putting our hands on our thigh. So this is a very general picture out of the content of this dua.
All right, Dr. Karimi, thank you so much for such a beautiful translation and the explanation of the content of the dua. We'll be back after a very short while. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes, like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever.
Dear listeners, we have with us Dr. Karimi, who is explaining about the content of Dua Ahad.
The next point, which is related to Dua Al-Ahd, is that there are a couple of other du'as with the same content, but they are not that related to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. For example, among the du'as that are recommended to be recited after the morning prayer, and interestingly, this du'a has been quoted by Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. The first part of it is Allahumma Rabban Nur al-Azim, so very similar to Dua al-Ahd. And in another part, we say that As'aluka an tusalli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And finally, it ends with wa an tufarraja anni kull gham min wa ham. Oh Allah, I ask you to relieve from me any kind of sadness and grief. Wa an tu'tiyani ma arju, and to give me what I'm hopeful of. وَآمُرُهُ إِنَّكَ عَلَىٰ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ. This has been mentioned by Sheikh At-Tusi in Misbah al-Mutahajjid. There is yet another dua, which is about monotheism and at-tawheed, and it is highly recommended to be recited in the holy month of Ramadan at the time of iftar. Again, it begins like dua al-Ahd, Allahumma Rabban Nur al-Azim wa Rabb al-Kusir al-Wasih, and ends with وَجْمَعْ لَنَا خَيْرَ الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ بِرَحْمَتِكَ يَا أَرْحَمَ الرَّحْمِينَ. And the last dua, which is similar to dua al-Ahd, is the famous dua which begins like Allahumma Balligh Mawlaya Sahib al-Zaman Salawatullahi Alayhi. And according to some scholars, it is a kind of summary of dua al-Ahd.
All right.
And it's been quoted by Ibn al-Mashari in Al-Mazar al-Kabir, page 662, that it is recommended for the people to recite this dua every day after the morning prayer. But as I mentioned, it's a summary. So we begin by asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to send our blessing to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Again, like Dua al-Ahd, we are not selfish. We are asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to send blessings on behalf of all
everyone,
the,
us. Yeah, we're using it in plural form.
Exactly. Jami' al-mu'minina wal-mu'minat. And the ending part of this special dua is Allahumma hadhi bay'atun lahu fi unuqi ila yawm al-qiyamah. Oh Allah, this is a covenant upon me until the day of judgment. So this is a very important point, and I think this is the most important part of the dua. The fact that every day after the morning prayer, because many believers used to recite Dua al-Ahd every day after the morning prayer, we come to this understanding that we, first of all, we do have a living imam. Many days pass without notifying the fact that, paying attention to the fact that we do have a living imam and we have some responsibilities toward him. There is a covenant, there is a kind of ahd between us and the imam. So this is showing the importance of reciting Dua al-Ahd every day. And when the imam says that you do it for 40 days, we know that we have narrations about the importance of 40. And when you do one action for 40 consecutive days, maybe it can change your attitude in a way that you may act upon that in the following days as well.
Yes.
So you may not continue to recite the dua, but for sure you will continue to remember the content of the dua because you have repeated the content for 40 days.
40 consecutive days.
40 consecutive days. It's highly recommended for us. It will take maybe less than 10 or 5 minutes, but we need to pay attention to the content. Please, it's not only about repeating some Arabic words. No, we need to pay
attention to the content.
To the content.
What the dua is saying.
Yeah, and one of the most important parts of the content is that covenant. There is a covenant, and it is referring to the fact that, first of all, we remember that we have a living imam, and we need to wait for him. We need to pray for his reappearance and do our best for hastening the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, which requires us to act upon our responsibilities, doing our obligations, and being away from the scenes and acts of disobedience. So this is